city, back of my neck getting dirt and gritty. Bend down, isn't it a pity? Doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city. All around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk harder than a match head.
Good evening, Santa Cruz and Monterey Bay. It's every other Sunday again, and this is Ronnie Lipschitz. You're listening to Sustainability Now, a radio show focused on environment, sustainability, and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. Today, we're going to range a little bit beyond the Monterey Bay. My guest is Dr. Rupa Basu, who is chief of the Air and Climate Epidemiology Section at the California Office on Environmental Health Hazards, and also a lecturer in the UC Berkeley School of Public Health. She's co-author of a recently published review article in the Journal of the American Medical Association Open Network online about the effects of air pollution and climate change on birth outcomes, and she conducts research as well on the health effects of climate change. So let's get started. Welcome to Sustainability Now, Dr. Basu.
Thank you so much for the invitation today.
Is it okay if I call you Rupa?
Of course.
Okay. So you have a PhD in epidemiology from Johns Hopkins University, and I imagine most of our listeners have some idea what epidemiology is, but maybe you could describe it in a little bit more detail using the current pandemic as a case study.
Sure. So epidemiology, I think, for a long time was not on anyone's radar until the pandemic. I feel like people are now understanding a little bit more what we do. It's primarily really a method that we use to determine causes or risk factors for diseases in human populations in a given area. So, there's different types of epidemiology. With the pandemic, that's more infectious disease epidemiology. My field is environmental epidemiology, and that's why I study climate change, specifically air pollution or heat and temperature.
And epidemiology relies pretty heavily on statistics, right?
Correct, yeah. Yeah, so all of our studies that we conduct rely on some kind of statistical analyses, and that's why a lot of epidemiology overlaps with biostatistics, but also it's really different methods that we use to determine the associations between given exposures and outcomes.
So, for instance, in the current situation, one of the efforts is to try and determine that relationship, right? How much exposure to an infected person you need to have in order to contract the disease, right?
Correct. Yes, that's part of it. A lot of it is also trying to determine vulnerable subgroups, who's most at risk. And also trying to figure out how to lower that risk. Once you get more and more information on an exposure and outcome, so in our studies it would be air pollution or heat, you can try to prevent a lot of the associated deaths and illnesses.
Mm-hmm. Final question about the pandemic. I mean, things are moving so quickly with the pandemic that it's pretty difficult to collect, accumulate the data in order to make, reliable, conclusions from that. I think what you usually study is spread out over longer periods of time, correct?
Correct. So usually we're not studying epidemics, outbreaks, or pandemics. And so this is a different type of study than what I normally conduct. My studies end up being, like you said, over longer time periods, more, diverse, larger populations in, areas throughout California, just because I work for the state government. We know a little bit more about, the things that I study. And so that's why there's some hypotheses that I can make based on previous studies. We don't have that as much with a pandemic.
Okay, well, we'll come back to that in a few minutes. So, I don't think many of our listeners are even aware that there is a state office of environmental health hazards in Berkeley, right? So what does the office do, and what do you do there in your position as chief of the air and climate epidemiology section?
Well, actually, our office is headquartered in Sacramento, but I work, when we all used to go to work, our office is also in Oakland, in downtown Oakland, so we have about over 100 employees, and I would say maybe about a 60-40 split with more in Sacramento. Our director is Dr. Lauren Zeiss, and most of the office, I would say, is has training in toxicology. Our section is a little bit different in that we conduct epidemiologic studies. Like I said, those are health studies. With air pollution, with heat, we always look at vulnerable populations. We also have a section now, a couple of people working on oil and gas emissions and also vulnerable populations there. On a larger scale for, we call the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, OEHA. It is part of the California Environmental Protection Agency. There are other offices as well. But on a larger scale with our office, we also look at reproductive and cancer hazards, pesticides, fish advisories. If you're familiar with Cal Envirosuite Screen, the California Climate Change Indicators Report, and I know I'm missing things, air toxics and other contaminants, chemicals. So that's in a real nutshell what our office does.
Do you do water as well? Or did
yes,
I miss
there
that?
There are also some water studies, and there's a Human Right to Water report as well as there's been some studies with arsenic in drinking water, and those are actually also epidemiologic studies.
Mm-hmm. So I always ask my guests this question: how did you get into this business?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I would say that, so I'm originally from India, and visiting India as a child really made a strong impression on me, and every time I would go, I would notice the really high levels of air pollution in the cities. Also, you know, the heat was just, you know, something like I had never, ever experienced in my life. And so I always wondered how much this is impacting health, and I feel like that question hasn't, at least at that time, hadn't been addressed so much. And now that we're getting some results in California and other parts of the country and the world, including India, I always kind of keep those results in my mind that, okay, if we're seeing these kinds of results in California, just think about what it is like in the developing world where, you know, the exposures are so much greater, there's less mitigation, and, of course, the populations are completely different. But I always want to bring it back to the very high-risk populations anywhere in the world. I think that's really important.
Mm-hmm. And so how did that then sort of motivate your, you know, your progress through education?
Well, I started... as a biology major at UC San Diego, then went on to, I was always interested in environmental science, wasn't really sure how to create a career out of that. I could think of even back in middle school, I had conducted a science project on oil spills and algae, so that also kind of, you know, sparked some interest. Then as I was at UCLA getting my master's in public health, I realized that, and that was in environmental sciences, I wanted to do something for people. Like I really wanted to take the research and all the background that I had in biology and environmental science and bring it to epidemiology. And by bringing it to epidemiology, I felt like, okay, now I can really study you know, people and diverse populations and subgroups and vulnerabilities and, you know, other issues like environmental justice issues and, you know, disparities and all those kinds of things. I felt like it all just kind of came together by the time I had started my PhD and I guess through the process of getting my PhD.
And so when you did your PhD, was it focused on birth outcomes?
No, actually, I was very lucky. I went to Johns Hopkins, as you said, and I had an advisor there, Dr. John Samet, who I went into Hopkins thinking I was going to study air pollution and respiratory health outcomes. That's what I thought I was going to study, you know, based on what I had seen in India, and I thought this is something I could bring, you know, just look at the U.S. population. And once I got there, they were already starting on this huge, is the NMAPS, I think it's the National Morbidity and Mortality Air Pollution Study. So they said, well, we're already doing that. And he gave me the idea of how about looking at heat and some of these health outcomes that you're interested in. And I didn't really know too much about the literature then. So I looked and I saw how little had been done. And I thought, okay, I think this is going to be a big problem, and you know, it will continue to be a big problem for some time. So I would like to do my dissertation on temperature and mortality among the elderly in the U.S. It was the 20 largest U.S. cities. I also did what we call an exposure assessment study to see how heat, ambient heat, affects the physiology of the body by, I think I had about 50 participants in Baltimore City who, you know, I hooked up to this monitor and just looked at activity level and heart rate, and we had this time activity diary and just looked at the association with the ambient temperature and the body temperature and the skin temperature and just tried to look at that all together to see what possibly could be the mechanism and why heat, you know, sometimes kills or makes people very sick.
Well, just a question about that. How were you monitoring people? Or did you have them in a lab, or were you following them around, you know, with some kind of wireless device?
Yes. So there was a device that I would, is a personal monitor, and I would put it on each person and then monitor them for 48 hours. And they had to have that monitor that basically monitored their skin temperature. I could get the ambient temperature readings from, you know, the monitors elsewhere. And then I would also get, there's a polar chest belt that they wore for heart rate. I know there's, I'm checking, this is 20 years ago now, so
yeah,
I know much, much more, you know, efficient ways to monitor heart rate and temperature. And then I had, like, a little activity monitor to see how that affected all of this in what we call effect modification, and then a time activity diary. And I basically put that in to see, like, for each hour, are you outside or inside? Are you in transit? Are there certain medications that you might be taking during this time? Are you in an air-conditioned environment? Are you using a fan? So all those kinds of things, because those are more effect modifiers that I could look at for temperature and I think I was looking at skin temperature and ambient temperature, that association, and others as well. But that was the main part.
And was this for a particular age group, or was it range?
Yeah, that was for the elderly. Uh-huh. And so, I went to a senior center and recruited 50 people. I think I ended up with a little less than 50, maybe 42 or something in the study. But we really wanted that to be more of a pilot study and expand that to a larger study, which hasn't happened. But that was the plan, at least at that time.
Yeah. We need to take a short break, so we'll be back and can talk some more about this article and your research on birth effects. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM on your radio dial in Santa Cruz and KSQD.org streaming on the internet. Over to you, Emily.
Wear a mask. Wear a mask. It's now clear that wearing a mask is one of the most effective ways to slow the spread of COVID. Help spread the word by making your own radio jingle to run on KSQD. Enter our Wear a Mask Jingle Contest. Top entries will be aired on KSQD, and the top three will receive a K-Squid t-shirt. Record it at home on your iPhone or recorder, and send it to info@ksqd.org. Put jingle in the subject line. Shorter is better, under a minute is the goal. Be creative. What rhymes with virus? What rhymes with mask? Does anything rhyme with pandemic? Use karaoke instrumentals for extras with parodies. Let's have fun reminding everyone to wear a mask. Entries due by August 10th. That's info@ksqd.org for our K-Squid Jingle Contest.
All right. You're listening to Sustainability Now on K-Squid. This is Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Dr. Rupa Basu, Chief of the Air and Climate Epidemiology Section at the California Office on Environmental Health Hazards. We've just been talking about her path to her current position and research. So how did you then get from looking at the impacts on the elderly to the impacts on the very young?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So when we first started this research, we really thought the most vulnerable subgroup, the elderly. When I started working for our office, I conducted a study that was California only, looking at several years of data, and I saw that we looked at infants in that study, so under one, and then also children, all the different age groups, and I actually saw that infants and young children had higher risk than the elderly, and so then that got me thinking that maybe there's other vulnerable subgroups that we should be looking at, and not just focusing our studies on the elderly anymore. And then actually, it's a very personal story how I became interested in trying to make this connection with birth outcomes. So with air pollution and birth outcomes, I did some of those studies when I was working at the U.S. EPA. And then with temperature, I got that idea because I'm one of those people that just always runs really cold. You know, it's like everybody else is comfortable and I've got the layers on. Okay. When I was pregnant the first time, I noticed that, like, I would just get kind of like, you know, what people refer to hot flashes, or just not being able to, like, regulate my temperature. And it was just a very different feeling for me. Then I would be, like, the warmest person in the room, and then sometimes I would go back to being the coldest. And it was just like, oh, wow, this mechanism that we call thermoregulation is what I have been saying is happening in the elderly, and now we've figured out it's also happening in infants. They can't thermoregulate or control their body temperature. And I think that's what's going on with me, too, being pregnant. And then during my second pregnancy, I had that same feeling again. You know, it went away, and then it came back again while I was pregnant. And then I started thinking, maybe there's an association between heat and adverse birth outcomes. So we had the data for preterm delivery, and so that's where I started the first study that was published back in 2010. And since then, we've also published studies on low birth weight and stillbirth as well.
So maybe you can describe, I'm getting some sort of feedback here, maybe you can describe, you know, how you go about then doing the research.
Okay, yeah, so the first thing we need for any research project is data. We need the data that, I had, like I said, California birth certificate data, and that included data on preterm delivery and low birth weight. So I thought that was a good place to start. And so the first study that I mentioned was between temperature and preterm delivery in California. At that time, there wasn't really a whole lot of research done on adverse birth outcomes with temperature. So I know there was going to be a lot of skepticism, but I thought, well, maybe if I publish this study, we'll start to see other studies in other locations. And that's exactly what happened. Then it's kind of like you're replicating the results in other populations with, you know, other risk factors and other things going on, but you're still seeing that association between temperature and preterm delivery. And so then, you know, it's very easy to get the environmental data. That's all publicly available. So temperature, air pollution, all of that is monitored. We can, you know, pick that up. There's also a lot of modeled data as well. You know, people are, you know, trying to make really small spatial, what I mean by that is like within 1 kilometer, they can make grids of data, and you could use that kind of data as well. But after conducting that first study, I, you know, found that all mothers were really at high risk, but there were some subgroups that were at higher risk, and I felt like I could better answer that question if I collaborated with the Kaiser Permanente Division of Research in Northern California. And so we went on to publish a couple more studies that really looked at the vulnerable subgroups because they have more, I guess we call them covariates or variables that we can look at that to really focus on the vulnerable populations.
Okay. And what did you find?
So I was starting to tell you some of the results that was kind of, I was not expecting to find that the heat and preterm delivery, I wasn't expecting to find all age groups and all mothers, regardless of race or ethnicity, to be at increased risk. But within those groups, we did find some variability. So for age, for example, younger mothers had greater risk. Among the race ethnic groups, it was African American mothers had the greatest risk for preterm delivery and heat, followed by Asian mothers, and then white and Hispanic mothers. I think it was Hispanic and then white mothers. So that was one of the findings. And then, of course, there's all these other factors like smoking or alcohol use or we call them comorbidities, like gestational or any pre-existing hypertension or diabetes or preeclampsia. All those things increase the risk. So while we had seen that all mothers in our study, there's a link between heat and preterm delivery, there was these certain subgroups that had sometimes even twice the risk as that overall population.
So how do you explain that? That variation.
Well, that's a really good question. That's one of the questions we're still trying to answer. We have some, I guess, hypotheses that we've been kind of thinking about. Part of it, I think, has to do with the exposure itself. You know, so air pollution, if we start with that, air pollutants are higher in certain neighborhoods, and so with the lower maternal age and with that race ethnic, I guess it was mostly minority populations, particularly African American moms who had the greater risk. It's really, there's nothing of biological difference that we're thinking. We're thinking it's probably more a measure of socioeconomic status for those findings. And it could be, you know, housing location. Many times, you know, living closer to freeways, being more exposed to traffic, more fossil fuel emissions, oil and gas emissions, you know, all of those kinds of things. If you think about housing characteristics, if there's more heat exposure, less green space also outside, you know, the housing characteristics, getting back to that, is, you know, less access to air conditioning or even less use of air conditioning because of the cost. So those kinds of factors, I think, play a key role. And, of course, most of the studies that I'm conducting now take place in California. So, but I suspect that a lot of these differences might be also seen elsewhere, but maybe measured differently in terms of socioeconomic status.
So the air pollution is something to which a mother is exposed over the, you know, the term, right, of pregnancy. And is heat exposure also that kind of long-term sorry, I'm having a senior moment here, does that also have long-term effects, or is it associated with, you know, late pregnancy and birth?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, so with heat exposure in general, it's actually a very short-term association. There have been studies that have also shown some long-term associations, but in our studies for heat, the preterm delivery study, for example, I was looking at just the week prior to delivery. So mm-hmm. that's why, you know, very short-term. Same thing with stillbirth. With the low birth weight, it was actually a little bit more of a long-term. So it was third trimester exposure as opposed to just that last week. So, you know, that's why I say it's both short-term and long-term. With other outcomes, though, like mortality or emergency room visits and hospital visits, we've also found those to be very short-term, which, of course, is important for public health response. It's, you know, we don't have a lot of time to really think about what to do when there's higher levels of heat exposure. And by that, I don't mean just heat waves. I just mean it's just hotter outside relative to other days. That's why it's very important to make plans before the actual exposure occurs.
Okay. So what can be done to reduce these kinds of outcomes? And I want to sort of get broader and talk about climate change and public health after our next break. But have you thought about, you know, it's not really your job, I suppose, but what can be done to reduce these effects?
Right. So I guess from our study results, there's a lot of implications, you know, and part of it is that I told you about the exposure already, but I didn't touch upon the outcome. So, like, if it's an outcome like preterm delivery, without even looking at heat or air pollution, we already know that in the U.S., African-American mothers have a worse, have a greater likelihood of having some kind of adverse birth outcome, such as preterm delivery. And there's so many, short and long-term problems that happen with a preterm delivery. So we're really trying to, limit these adverse outcomes. But when you add in heat and air pollution, we're seeing that there's still that disparity there. And, of course, it's just another factor to add on top of what we already had, just worse birth outcomes in general. So part of the problem is access to health care. Or even if there is the same access to health care, sometimes there could be some kind of differential treatment, or maybe not having the same resources, the same type of care because of, you know, different race or ethnicity. Now, for some other minority groups, there could be language barriers. There are, less insurance issue. I mean, more insurance issues. Like, I know there's studies to show that populations who use the emergency room as primary care versus those who don't are very different. So I think, you know, we've really got issues on the exposure and the outcome. And to fix both of these issues, we have to really kind of do a multi-level approach, you know. So some of these things are, like I said, are very preventable. And if we can try to address, some of the exposure issues and some of these outcome issues, I think that could really help bring down the illnesses or deaths or adverse birth outcomes from heat or air pollution.
Mm. Okay, let's take a break here. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz on your radio dial and KSQD.org streaming on the internet. Over to you, Emily.
Did you know a squid has three hearts? So when K-Squid sends out a heartfelt thanks to everyone who filled out our online listener survey, we mean it. And congratulations to Jenny Gill, Chris Clark, Matt Farrell, Catherine Ramirez, and Mike Ryan. They're the winners in our listener survey contest. If you haven't done it already, it's not too late to let us know your thoughts about our station by going to the listener survey page on our website, ksqd.org.
You're listening to Sustainability Now on KSQD. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz. My guest today is Dr. Rupa Basu, Chief of the Air and Climate Epidemiology Section at the California Office on Environmental Health Hazards. We've just been talking about her research on air pollution at heat exposure and the correlations with preterm birth, low birth weight, and stillbirth, particularly in California. Let's shift over to the broader question of climate change and public health. What are the current and anticipated impacts of climate change on people's health and well-being?
Yeah, well, we're already seeing the effects of climate change. Most of our studies, I would say about 95% of our studies, are actually looking at current or past levels. By past, I mean from 1999 or 2000, onward to the current years, of air pollutants or temperature. So if we're already seeing these types of effects, and we know that in many areas heat will get worse, air pollution will get worse, we just have to think about what that means for the future. And some of our studies do look at some projections for the future, and there's a lot more other research that really focuses more on that aspect. But just overall, what we have found is that the projections that we had made for 2020, for example, are worse than what we had thought. So that's, we have other projections based on emissions, greenhouse gas emissions and other emissions for 2050 and also at the turn of the next century, 2100. And we're trying to figure out what that would mean for health outcomes. A lot of people are really focused more on I'm just giving an example of how much temperature will increase by these future dates. But we take those projected increases and then try to figure out what that means for health outcomes. And that's research that we we haven't done as much of that as we would like, but we'd like to try to do more of that as well.
Yeah, so another one of your articles, you noted that California is unique. And this is a sort of a long bit here, but I want to read it. It's unique since temperature and humidity tend to be relatively mild, while pollutant levels are generally high with distinct sources and patterns of exposure. Furthermore, people spend more time outdoors throughout the year in California, lending them the potential for more exposure to heat, air pollution, smoke, as well as vector-borne diseases. That's a sort of an interesting observation, right? Because we associate going outside with fresh air and well-being, especially in California. So maybe you can, say something about, that oddity?
Sure. So what I was trying to say is that in California, our exposure patterns are different. So in other parts of the U.S., for example, there might be more time spent outdoors when the weather's nice in the spring or fall or sometimes the summer. But in California, for most places anyway, we really spend a lot more time outdoors throughout the entire year. And that means more exposure to heat or air pollution or potential exposure. And I guess the way I like to think about it is with smoking, something like smoking, it's really individual exposure. Of course, there's passive smoke exposure where you're affecting other people. But with something like heat or air pollution, it's harder to say, oh, there's just a few of us who are being exposed. It's everywhere. And so if you go outside, you're going to be exposed. You know, there's ways to probably reduce exposure. You know, you could think about with heat, you know, if it's super hot outside, probably don't go out exercising then to reduce exposure. With air pollution, same thing. There's, you know, different times of the day that the pollution is just higher, for example, during commuting hours. So there are ways to alleviate the exposure, but it's always there. And even if you're indoors, we know that there's some air exchange or ventilation between the outdoor and indoor environments, and that also means that you aren't really ever completely getting away from these environmental exposures.
Does your office do any research on indoor air pollution?
There is some. I wouldn't say research. I think you know, other state offices, such as the California Air Resources Board, they do some work on indoor air exposure, and you know, we've been involved with some of the reports and the reviews with them and other agencies as well.
Well, I ask because I'm curious about the comparative risks of indoors and outdoors. Do you know anything about that? I mean, have you found anything about around that?
Right. So the only indoor study that I have been have worked on is a study that I told you about at the very beginning, where we were doing that monitoring study.
But
I'm not as familiar with that research, but I do know that there's you know, some exposure from different sources also indoor. So I talked about how some of the outdoor pollution or heat is also, you know, trickling in indoors. Well, there's something like gas stoves, for example, have nitrogen dioxide exposure, so you could get exposure from that. You know, there's a lot of other kitchen appliances, depending on what people are using, you could get exposure. So there's, you know, some work on that as well. But I haven't been as well-versed in that aspect of climate change as much as the outdoor ambient exposures.
No, well, I wouldn't expect you to be doing everything. So let me go on, because there's some more interesting stuff in this particular article. So air conditioning use or air conditioner use is not a surrogate for socioeconomic status, as it may be in other parts of the country. Many homes in coastal areas do not have air conditioning installed because predominantly cool temperatures minimize the need, although coastal homes tend to be more expensive and thus consist of a wealthier population. Thus, people living in coastal areas may be more impacted by a heat wave since they do not have air conditioning in their homes and are not acclimatized to high ambient temperatures. Well, I mean, I know that when the temperature in Santa Cruz goes above 80 degrees, then, you know, I wilt. So I guess that's sort of the evidence. But isn't it still the case in California nowadays more and more that, you know, wealthier households are more likely to have air conditioning?
Right, or installing, I know, installing more air conditioning now. But it's not just about the air conditioning. It's also about, you know, if you're accustomed to certain heat or, you know, levels of temperature or not. So you mentioned in Santa Cruz, an 80-degree day or, you know, average 80-degree day is pretty similar to, you know, San Francisco, where that would probably constitute, you know, a heat wave, because you're thinking that sometimes the temperatures would go above 90, right? So, but think of the same temperature levels in Sacramento or the Central Valley, for example. That would be a really mild day for them. So while more of the homes have air conditioning, you know, whether people use it or not is another issue, but still most of the places have air conditioning. But when temperatures get up to about 120 degrees, which sometimes we see there, you know, how much can you really do? You know, there's times that you just have to go outside and you have to, you know, just get, you know, even essentials. And so living in 120 degree weather, that would constitute a heat wave there. I mean, obviously less than that too. But we're finding that we are able to adapt somewhat. So, you know, if you're used to, you know, an 80-degree day, average temperature day, then, you know, you would be fine. But other people are, you know, living in milder climates, and they would not be able, you know, very comfortable in that kind of environment. So what we're finding is actually, it's called a minimum mortality temperature, is lower in places like Santa Cruz or San Francisco compared to places like, oh, what I mentioned, Sacramento. Fresno. You know, just because of what people are used to. So that's why you would see more, if the coastal areas are going to have more rapid warming, then we would see more health associations in coastal areas. Already we see some differences between coastal and non-coastal areas, but that's why. I think it's, you know, the lack of air conditioning, but even more than that, I think it's a lack of being exposed to higher temperature, so your body can't adapt as easily.
You know, I wonder about that, because I know when I've gone into the Central Valley in the summer, it's always brutal. You know, I grew up in Houston, so I know what brutal heat is. But you know, everything's air conditioned in Houston. So trying to parse this then in terms of public health, who is at most at risk from climate change in California, the coast or the interior?
Okay, so my answer to that would be that everyone is at risk from climate change, but for different reasons. So the Central Valley has very high levels of air pollution. You know, sometimes we also get high levels of air pollution out here. And, of course, Los Angeles has very high levels of air pollution. But in terms of heat, what I said before, if you're not as accustomed to heat or you don't have ways to mediate heat exposure, then that's going to also put, you know, people on the coast at higher risk. So really it's like there's different things going on. And when I was talking about the heat adaptation, like I said, when you get to temperatures like 120 degrees, I mean, the human body can only adapt so much. Once you get to that level, there's probably not a whole lot of adaptation going on anymore.
Are we expecting that in the Central Valley? I mean, I know it sometimes gets that warm, but that's unusual. But is that
right.
is that one of the projections?
Yeah, it has gotten to that level already. So, you know, I think the predictions are that we're going to see more heat waves. We're going to see longer duration heat waves, more frequent heat waves. So all of those things mean that, and this is an overall projection, means that there will be warming in the coast as well as the Central Valley.
Yeah. There was one thing in one of the articles about the concept of mortality displacement, which I found a little bit puzzling. And I wonder, and I want to bring that back to COVID. We'll probably do that after the break. But what does that mean, that term?
Okay, so mortality displacement is, it's also known as harvesting. And what it means is it refers to this phenomenon that people who are dying from a given exposure, such as COVID or air pollution, are the most frail of the population, and they would have died anyway, regardless of exposure. So I know that sounds insensitive, but that's, you know, from a public health point of view, we want to see if people are higher risk from a given exposure. Well, if they were going to die regardless of exposure, then it's not as much of a public health issue. And the way that we could see that is if we see, we're always looking at excess deaths. So if we see excess deaths initially, but then after a couple of days, we see that kind of dip back down to maybe lower levels of deaths than usual, then we would say that's mortality displacement, because you're just displacing the mortality by a couple of days. So that's kind of what that refers to. Does that make sense?
I think so. So, I mean, this is basically the level of deaths in different age categories above the background, you might say, the sort of steady level,
yes,
right? Yeah.
Right. Right, and often it refers to the elderly population because that's just, in general, where we see most of the deaths.
Yeah, I need to take another break, but sure. I do have another question about related to that. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and KSQD.org streaming on the internet. Over to you, Emily.
Thanks, Ronnie. This week on The Cutting Edge, Patrick Hart speaks with Charlotte Ekman, a PhD student at UC Santa Cruz, about her research on marine phytoplankton. These microscopic organisms living in the ocean perform half of the world's photosynthesis. Every other breath you take is thanks to these tiny creatures. Charlotte shares how these organisms are affected by climate change and how they can help us. Join KSQD for an in-depth look at field research and diversity in science on The Cutting Edge tonight at 7:30 p.m. here on KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org. Many voices, one station. Back to you, Ronnie.
Thank you, Emily. You're listening to Sustainability Now. This is Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Dr. Rupa Basu, Chief of the Air and Climate Epidemiology Section at the California Office on Environmental Health Hazards, and we're talking about climate change and public health. So I read recently, and I looked for the source and couldn't find it, that the majority of California's COVID cases now are in the 15 to 35 age range, while the majority of deaths appear to be in those 60 and older. Actually, there was some weird thing about that the highest level was amongst those between 50 and 60 and not 60 and older. And is that an example of mortality displacement?
So that would be mortality displacement if the people who died from COVID in this case would have died regardless of whether there is COVID or not. Okay? So I guess you mentioned something about the cases being higher in that younger age group, the 15 to 35, but the mortality being greater in the 50 to 60-year-old, or maybe even greater than that, age group. And that's an important finding because it means that the older age group is at higher risk, even though you have more cases in the younger age group. And I'm just talking in general, in a broader term, that these older, that's the high-risk group for mortality. The high-risk group for morbidity would be that younger age group.
What's the difference between morbidity and mortality then?
So mortality is deaths, and then morbidity might be, you know, cases measured as emergency room visits or hospital visits or what we say birth outcomes. So those are like different categories. So when we're talking about mortality displacement, that really refers to the deaths.
Yeah. Well, I'm just asking because those of us who are over 60, of course, are particularly concerned about these kinds of things. So what kind of research are you conducting now or you plan to do in the future? Anything, different or expansions of this?
Yeah, something that we're doing a little different, I guess, is looking at some of the California wildfires. So since, I guess, the last 3 years, we've gotten a lot of data on wildfires that have hit Northern California. So our first study is a study conducted for the 2017 Napa-Sonoma fires, and that will hopefully be that was submitted for publication, hopefully will come out in the next few months. But those studies focus on the fine particles from the wildfires, and we're just seeing such a higher level than we've ever seen with these fires exposed, and it's like these areas that are highly populated are being affected. And so we're trying to look at the health impacts of that. So is it higher levels of hospital visits and emergency room visits? And if so, from what specific causes? You know, is it respiratory? Is it some respiratory subgroups? That kind of thing. We've also started to look at mental health studies from temperature. That was published a couple of years ago because there's more evidence to show that heat really increases the risk for violent behavior. I was starting to see some reports of that. So I looked at temperature and mental health in general, then some neurotic outcomes and psychotic outcomes, and also homicides and suicides. Now we're doing a similar study with air pollutants, and that there's a study of nitrogen dioxide and carbon monoxide coming out soon. We found that there was actually a pretty strong risk with homicides specifically for those air pollutants. So that's some of the newer stuff.
You know, I mean, I remember reading in the past about homicides in places like New York City during heat waves. But it's interesting that pollution can also do that.
Right. I wouldn't even have thought about it except... Oh, go ahead.
I'm just wondering, what's the mechanism there?
Yeah, so some of the mechanism is... So there's a lot of neurological outcomes that have been now connected with air pollution. There's some evidence to suggest that maybe the air pollutants, like they cross the barrier between, you know, they go into the lungs, and sometimes, you know, the fine particles go deeper into the lungs. It's the same thing. Maybe there's also some, you know, fine particles crossing the barrier from the brain, from the blood to the brain.
Yeah.
So that could be, you know, one of the mechanisms. They're thinking that, like, when we're looking at things like heat, there might be some medications like antidepressants or beta blockers. I guess that's more of a heart thing. But that might actually modify that association between, so make those people who are taking those medications at higher risk during heat waves. So that's very connected. Also, you know, maybe some of these medications are making people less mobile, so that, you know, mental, you know, things like depression, psychosis, schizophrenia, all those things get worse when with higher air pollution or with higher levels of heat. So those are some of the mechanisms that we've run across so far.
Well, it sounds like it's always something, or there are all of these kinds of things we have to worry about.
Right.
Well, is there anything else that I might have left out that you'd like to talk about?
Well, I think you did a really good job about, I guess, covering so many different aspects of climate change and health. I can't think of anything else specifically. We covered all the vulnerable populations, which is always what I really like to talk about, and even some of the personal stories that got me involved, which I really haven't been asked about too much before. So that really got me to think about that, I could really, you know, find some, I guess, parts of my life where I felt like made a big impact on me for my career without knowing it, but you only know it in retrospect.
Right.
Yep.
Well, usually I don't run out of questions quite so soon. So maybe I can ask something about the office again.
Sure.
What sort of activities then does your office engage in beyond doing this kind of research?
I think there's been a shift of doing a lot of community-level research as well. So, from the studies that we talked about, a lot of it has been, you know, larger population public health studies, and that's generally what we do as epidemiologists. But now there's kind of like, okay, so now we know that there's, some populations at greater risk. Now, what do we do about this? How do we get the communities involved, and how do we maybe, figure out exactly what they're being exposed to from something like, let's say, oil and gas emissions, if that is, making the populations sicker or, disadvantaged in some way, just trying to really highlight areas that are higher risk. So when I'm talking about that, I think the first thing that we, in recent years that we started is this calendar screen, where there's so many different factors that we're looking at for risk. and trying to figure out which areas are at greatest risk by looking at things like air pollution and, you know, so many different markers for poverty or lower socioeconomic status, and going to those communities to really talk about some of the, you know, reasons for these differences, how to make some improvements. There's also some, there's more evidence from, you know, oil and gas emissions, and of course they're also in some very already disadvantaged communities, and trying to go, you know, really find those communities and do some more outreach. It's a little harder now with the pandemic, of course, but we're still trying to figure out what, really trying to figure out what the exposures are, and that's so key, because if we can figure out, you know, do a better exposure assessment, we can really try to, you know, move further along and look at what health outcomes could be associated with those exposures. So those are some of the,
no,
the things that are often more
it strikes
generally.
Me.
Yeah.
It strikes me that, you know, now you could do your original monitoring project, but with, you know, a lot of real-time data that the kinds of instruments and communications and things would make it would actually overwhelm you, I suppose, with data, but sort of discrimination in terms, in spatial terms and in other terms. Anyway, well, that's someone's PhD project, I imagine.
Oh, yeah,
there,
I think that's
right?
going to be a lot of people's PhD projects and probably a whole career that they can keep themselves busy with for quite some time.
Okay, well, listen, we're just about out of time, and I want to thank you so much for being on the show. This is Dr. Rupa Basu from the California California Office on Environmental Health Hazards. She's the chief of the Air and Climate Epidemiology Section, and we've been talking about climate change and public health and heat impacts on birth outcomes and the like. And I will, on the website of the radio with the broadcast, I'll also add some resources if anyone's interested in pursuing these further. So thank you very much, Rupa.
Yeah, thank you so much, Ronnie.
All right. On my next show on August 23rd, please join me and my guest, Kim Stanley Robinson. He is well known as the author of many science fiction classics, such as the Mars Trilogy. My favorite of his books is the California or Three California or Orange County Trilogy, which includes a volume called Pacific Edge, which is really about sort of ecological politics. His recent work, such as New York 2140, has addressed environmental and climate issues, and his forthcoming book, The Ministry for the Future, which is coming out in October, imagines a new global organization that advocates for the world's future generations and protects all living creatures, present and future. And I'm hoping we can have a conversation about that and about California and some other sort of futurist topics. That's on Sunday, August 23rd, 5 to 6 p.m., right here on KSQD 90.7 FM and ksqd.org on the internet. And as a reminder for those of you who get up with the sun, although again, the sun is coming up later and later now, shows from this 5 to 6 p.m. Sunday slot are rebroadcasted the following Tuesday morning from 6 to 7 a.m. And you can listen to previous shows on ksqd.org/sustainabilitynow and at sustainablesystemsfoundation.org. I want to thank Emily Dunham for her sterling engineering and everyone else at the station who makes this show possible. And so until next every other Sunday, Sustainability Now.
Hot town, summer in the city, back of my neck getting dirt and gritty. Bend down, isn't it a pity? Doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city. All around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk harder than a match hit.